Welcome to the podcast of Story Story Night. Story Story Night is a live storytelling program in Boise, Idaho, inspired by The Moth. More information can be found at storystorynight.org. Both of today's stories were recorded at the live event on the 26th of April, 2010, at the Lennon Building in Boise, Idaho. The theme of the event was Busted, stories about getting caught in the act. Today's first story is by Phil Gordon. Phil tells a story of constitutional justice and cops getting in trouble.
Unlike the previous two speakers, this is not a personal tale of me getting busted. It's a much easier story for me to tell because I don't have to dig up anything painful in my psyche. In fact, it's a third-party story. And it also is something of a reversal because I've been defending people for going on 33 years now as a criminal defense lawyer. All right? I feel like a prosecutor just jumped into my space. And when you defend people, you frequently have to deal with prosecutors and very often police officers. And in your practice of criminal defense, you oftentimes encounter prosecutors and police officers that you think aren't telling the truth. This may come as a shock to folks that these kind of people sometimes lie. But they're engaged in what a late Supreme Court justice, a wonderful man named Robert Jackson, who was Franklin Roosevelt's attorney general, he called it the often competitive business of ferreting out crime. And sometimes in the manner of being in the competitive business, they do things that take a competitive edge, and they aren't always honest and truthful. Robert Jackson also is famous, by the way, for a quotation about the institution of the grand jury. He said, "In the hands of a competent prosecutor, a grand jury could be made to indict a ham sandwich," which is another of his great lines. Well, this is a story about cops getting busted rather than other folks getting busted. And I liked it too. I like these kind of stories. And this story has a lot of really colorful elements. And it begins and ends in Spokane, and the people who were vindicated when the cops were busted were gypsies. And in particular, it was the King of the Northwest Gypsies, whose name was Grover Marks. And his son was named James Senator Marks. And they lived in side-by-side houses on Thor Street in Spokane. And this was in the 80s. And the Spokane police and Sheriff's Department in those days were even more corrupt than we sometimes think our local gendarmes are. And these guys were notoriously willing to bend the law and the rules. And they were very concerned about the Marxes, who they believed were conducting a large-scale fencing operation. They were buying hot goods. And they had used some confidential informants who told them tales of going to the Marx's homes on Thor Street and selling stolen goods. But they really wanted to make a good, strong case. So they got an informant who was willing to wear a wire and go in and sell hot goods to the King of the Northwest Gypsies and his son. So sometime in 1986, this fellow started going to the home of the Marxes, and nothing conclusive came of it. Couple times, and finally they sent him again wearing a wire to sell them some things. And they were, of course, listening on the other end to what was going on there, hoping to be able to document a case. Well, they were listening, and they could tell all of a sudden that it wasn't going well, that the gypsies had made this person, that they knew he was a CI, knew he was wired, and they decided to pounce. Now, in order to understand this story and the intricacies of it, we need to understand a few basic legal concepts. One is called the Fourth Amendment. And we probably all know about the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And it prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures and requires warrants in order for police to go into a home, particularly a home which is the most sacred place in our jurisprudence. It's recognized as being a person's castle, and the highest standards of probable cause need to be met before you can get a warrant to invade someone's home. The other thing that's real helpful to understand is when a judge has a law enforcement officer or someone appear in front of them to get a warrant, that person either has to bring a written affidavit or they have to testify under oath, and the testimony is preserved. And if a judge makes a decision to issue the warrant, they endorse the warrant as to the very minute it was issued. Officers who know that a warrant's been signed in the judge's chambers can hear about this from the officer who's there, and they don't need to have the physical warrant in their hands to go into the house. As soon as they know it's been signed, they can act on the existence of that warrant. Well, all right, so there's enough of a digression in the technical, boring legal stuff. Well, so anyway, the Spokane police officers were hearing this, their case going south, and they were realizing their CI had been made. So they went in, and they went in en masse to the two homes on Thor Street, the home of Grover Marks and the home of his son, James Senator Marks. And they had a field day. They found countless people there, many branches of the gypsy clans there, and everybody from the youngest six-month-old child who had gold earrings to the oldest grandmother or grandfather was heavily bedecked with jewelry. And they figured it was all stolen. So what they did was they set up some tables and they took every single piece of jewelry from every single person. They took every pair of earrings, from the youngest babies. They took every necklace. They took every bracelet. They took, no, necklaces are here. Bracelets are here. Yeah, I thought that was funny. They took all the necklaces, all the bracelets, all the watches, and they laid them out on a table, and they videotaped them using state-of-the-art 1986 technology so that they could make sure to account for them and make sure that they could show them to the public if anybody wanted to claim them. And they also, under the floorboards in James Senator Marks's house, found a stash of $1.6 million in cash. Yeah, and they took that too. Seven containers full of money that was counted at the home, and it totaled $1.6 million. Well, they then arrested several of the gypsies, claiming that they were dealing in stolen goods, and they charged them with the felonies of possessing stolen property. Well, the gypsies went and they hired some really good lawyers. This is not a plug. This is not a plug, I promise you. And the lawyers they hired researched the case, and they filed something called a motion to suppress. A motion to suppress is a motion directed to the judge, and it says basically, judge, you have to exclude or suppress this evidence from use in this case because it was obtained as a result of a constitutional violation. Well, in this case, the violation they allege was that the officers had come into the homes without a warrant. And so a hearing was held, as a hearing should be held on these. And the first uncontrovertible piece of evidence were the warrants themselves that were endorsed at 3:10 p.m. So at 3:10, the officer who was there with the judge saw the judge sign and endorse the warrant, and at that point they could call over to the officers at the homes and say, we've got a warrant, go ahead. Well, the gypsies claimed that the officers had come in hours before, and all the officers, to a woman and a man, took the stand and said, oh, no, 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 no. We waited until we knew that the warrants had been signed before we went into that home. They were lying. Every single one of them was lying. And the evidence just kept getting better and better to show that they were lying. The first piece of evidence was the postman. And he testified and said, I've been delivering mail to these homes for over 20 years. I've had the same route. And I always, always, always go to these homes between 10 to 1 and 10 after 1. And when I got there on that day, there was already crime scene tape up, and the officers were already in the house, and I couldn't go up on the porch to deliver the mail. Well, all right, so, you know, he could have maybe been mistaken. He's just human. He could have been wrong about that day. He might not have remembered it specifically, but that was good evidence. The next piece of evidence was an ambulance dispatch call that was received at 2:56 p.m., and it said that one of the people in the house was having serious distress and that the search was almost completed by then. Mind you, that's 15 or 14 minutes before the warrants were endorsed. But the absolutely coup de grace, the single piece of evidence that was totally unarguable and uncontrovertible, came from the videotape. If you remember, they took all of the, I'll get it right this time, necklaces, all of the bracelets, all of the earrings, and all of the watches. And they laid them out on a table and videoed them. And as they were panning over the watches all just happened to show time in the area of 10 after 1. And one of them was a digital watch that went from 108 to 109 as the videotape was going over it. And there were enough watches that they all squared in time. And there was evidence that several of them were working, and at least one changed from 1 minute to the other as the camera was panning over it. So this was a pretty easy case. And as a result, all of the evidence was suppressed and the charges were dismissed. The court ordered the police to give everything back to the people from whom they'd seized it. The problem was that over $400,000 in cash had mysteriously disappeared between the time it was counted in the home to the time it got to the police station. So in this case, the case wound its way through the courts for years up in Spokane, both the state and federal courts. And if anybody's really interested in reading the ultimate disposition of it, it's a case called The State of Washington versus Grover, Philip Marks, and Others. And it was decided by the Supreme Court of Washington on May 3rd, 1990. It took 4 years to get there. And it's reported in the National Reporter System what they call 790 Pacific Second 138. And it tells the whole tale of this. And so that story made me especially happy because in that case, justice was done, and ultimately it was the police who were busted.
Today's story slammer is Deborah Smith. Deborah shares a story about young love and blue lights in Berkeley.
Okay, if I slur my words, it's because my lunch was stolen today. Even though we lock the door to the faculty lounge, my half of a hamburger, which is left over from last night, was stolen. I think it was the gypsies. But anyway, I want to tell a story about being busted, but it was so subtle that the person to whom it happened didn't even really know it until it was too late. And imagine, if you will, 1974, Berkeley. It was the first year of the co-ed dorm. That's what we fought Vietnam for, I'm sure. Something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there. You know, okay. So, but really, The problem with the co-ed dorm is that it has co-ed bathrooms, and I was constipated for months. And I went to Berkeley with my fiancé. We were both English majors. We read Keats. We memorized Shakespeare. We cut Shakespeare class to go canoeing. It was so romantic. And we were in a co-ed dorm, but boys were on 7 and girls were on 6. But my roommate was very mature, and she had a boyfriend in Berkeley on Shattuck Avenue, not in the dorms. I never saw her. She was a soc major. And so that twin bed was shared by me and my fiancé all semester long. And then June hit, and we had to return to the parents' home. We were horny as hell. And it was July, and it was California, and those rolling hills with the wild oats and the scrub oaks were beckoning us. Did I say we were horny? We were. And so we loaded up the green Volkswagen with a mat and a bottle of wine. We weren't 21 yet. It was so hot. And he had picked this night because it was a full moon. Did I say we were horny? It had been like 3 weeks. And we were 20. So we rolled out the mat, and we pushed down those wild oats, and we kissed, and we drank wine, and then the blue lights came up the dirt road to the wild oats, and they parked just discreetly down the road from the scrub oak. And my fiancé, who read Keats, said, "I'll take care of it." And I knew he was the one. And so he put on his 501s, button fly, no underwear. And he put on the moccasins that he himself had made. He was so hot. And he walked down to meet the two men who wore polyester. And I pulled on, "Where's my underwear? Where's my underwear? Oh my God." But he was in control. And he came back, and he walked up to the scrub oak, and the moon was rising, and attached to the thought of his 501s was my pink, lacy underwear.
The Story Story Night podcast is produced by Boise State Public Radio. Pledge your support at radio.boisestate.edu. Story Story Night is a monthly live storytelling program created and presented by Alley Repertory Theater, the Boise State University Story Initiative, and The Cabin. Story Story Night is inspired by The Moth. Music for Story Story Night is by Dan Costello. Listen to more of Dan's music at hearcostello.com. Thank you for listening.